On this week's 51%, we meet an author and activist whose anthology aims to draw readers closer to inclusion and understanding.
Women's voices have been muted for so long.
Hear from a military spouse about how frequent moves take their toll, and writer Dr. Jerry Byrne shares a story about appropriate public displays. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. I'm not just the brown girl in the rain. I'm a girl that likes to sing. Following the Women's March in January 2017, there's been a growing sense of solidarity among women who refuse to be silenced. We witnessed the emergence of the Me Too movement, with women stepping forward to share the stories of sexual abuse and assault, and we've seen powerful men removed from their posts in the process. Or go to Atlantic County in New Jersey, where medical professional Ashley Bennett ran against then-freeholder John Carman after he mocked the Women's March. She won. Activist and author Deborah Santana also wants women's voices heard, women of color. After putting out a call for submissions, her book contains 69 of the more than 300 essays submitted. I spoke with Santana about All the Women in My Family Sing, Women Write the World, Essays on Equality, Justice, and Freedom, an anthology of prose and poetry.
So everyone who's in the book is of color. All of the people who worked on the book, the graphic design, the cover design, the other editor that I used, and even our accountant are all women of color. And it's to make a statement, but also we're hoping for a call to action that more women of color will consider being in publishing because it is not really diverse or open in that sense. And also that all people will read women of color and stories and understand that our stories are so similar, but women of color have not been given a platform.
You know, it's interesting about the publishing industry because if you look in the headlines, we're looking at other industries that we're now made aware are not fairly representing women. So fair representation for women of color in publishing is something for which to strive.
I started this project 3 years ago, and it was already very apparent to me and to my co-publisher, but also in my own life, being a biracial woman who grew up in San Francisco in the 1950s and 60s, my entire life, I have been aware of this. Who is not in the room? And it's important for every industry, friends, you know, as we look around in our communities and our churches, who's not in the room? And we still have these segregated environments and doors that are closed to people of color.
Now, readers may recognize some authors' names, some not, and certainly the stories run the gamut, as they should in any good anthology, right? So were you consciously selecting stories to represent such a wide variety of experience?
Well, you know, it really was just reading and feeling the essence and also the quality of the writing. And that was how the final choices were made, based on the content of the story and the passion in the story. Not necessarily trying. We wanted them to be filled out into these wonderful segments that we have, or the sections that we have. But the topics actually came from the submissions. We didn't choose to have certain areas in the beginning. It was the stories began with editing identity and being at home in the world. And these ended up being universal stories, trailblazers and stargazers about career, and then about social justice and equality, and then, of course, about family and friendship. And so much we've always talked about in communities of color, and all women, about beauty and how it's defined by the culture or the society rather than about what we believe about ourselves.
What story or stories, I'm sure more than one, really sing to you?
Well, you know, they all, I'm in love with all of them. All of the stories are powerful. I actually asked Marion Wright Edelman to give me an essay because she's one of my heroes, and she has worked in social justice and our government for so long for the rights of children. So I love hers. I love Natalie Bazile's about going back before she wrote Queen Sugar and before it was popularized on the Oprah Channel with a wonderful series that's on her story about her father and leaving Louisiana because it was so brutally racist. But I love Blair Topesh Caldwell, who's she's a PhD student in the Department of Anthropology at University of New Mexico, and she writes about reclaiming indigenous space. So we have, oh, and so many stories. I mean, beloved Hal Money, who the Korean grandmother who raised 10 children, and they're all stunning. Stunning representations of what we women do in our lives, in our daily lives.
What is the relevance of these stories to what's going on the U.S. stage?
Well, first of all, we're going to start with America Ferrera's We Are America, which is a transcript of her speech at the 2017 Women's March, and I was there with chills running up and down my body as she was speaking. The theme is we are all America, and what has happened with this time and leading up to this time of new presidential representation of excluding people, kicking people out, turning our country backwards instead of being inclusive as it was in the Obama era and giving rights to more and more people and the land and the environment and to science, trusting science and believing science. Her speech certainly speaks, I mean, it was her speech, but her essay speaks to this time, as well as does Porochista Kapoor. You know, she's talking about home and about the immigration ban and about going through security at an airport as a woman of color who people don't know who she is. How do you pronounce her name? Where are you from? Go back to where you came from. All of these issues that are happening today and have been incited because of the current administration's racism.
Do you perceive a horrible hierarchy of discrimination? Is it gender first and then racism, or racism first then gender?
That's so interesting. I mean, I really feel our country was built on a racist paradigm. And I think that it has continued to be perpetuated because of the lack of true information given in our educational system and the dearth of truth about what people of color have contributed to the society, much less the enslaved people who built our country. So I do think racism starts, and unfortunately, and then gender, of course, has always been a part of it. I mean, not only were people of color not allowed to vote, but women were not allowed to vote. So this white patriarchal system has really been able to sustain itself for centuries and for much too long. So I think the awakening that people are experiencing now and feeling empowered to change, and the injustice of the firearms and thinking that we have the right to bear arms and that's going to make our society safe or just, all of these issues are something that we have worried about, and a lot of us have been socially active to try to make justice for decades. But we're still having the fight.
You know, at times out of negativity or trauma comes positive change. Is this a time where women, women of color, immigrants, you name it, in this environment, is this the time for positive change?
I wish I could say emphatically that I am hopeful that this is the time of change, that change will occur. I really don't know. I am encouraged because the conversation has now become larger. To have these young high school students getting in buses and traveling to the capitals of their states, starting in Florida and planning a march in Washington, D.C., I am encouraged by that because we're leaving this country in their hands, and they want to participate and make a change in the direction this country is going. So I don't know if change is lasting here. There is a bastion of white patriarchy that is not letting go because it owns the wealth. It has the wealth. It has reaped benefit from all of our suffering. So I choose to be hopeful, and I choose to trust that we are going to continue this march. And I do think people say that this whole administration is, some people say, that it is a result of the wonderful Obama years. It was wonderful for many of us, but it was horrible for those who wanted the white patriarchy to continue its reign. So they say this may be a backlash. I don't really believe that. I believe this has been an undergirding system in our country. But I do have hope, and I do know that the will of the people is what makes a democracy.
You know, and we're seeing more women running for office on all levels. So it seems there is change, whether it's lasting.
The change has to come from within. When I was growing up and we were protesting the Vietnam War, there was a poster that said, "War is not healthy for children and other living things." And my mom had that poster on our wall. And I really believe that it is a spiritual change. I mean, we have to care about others. We must not feel that we live in a vacuum or that there are sides or, you know, the point is that all humanity must grow and change together. And of course, that is a very idealistic viewpoint, but that is where I live. And I live in that, and that is why I wanted it to be all women of color. I want all of us to see how similar we are, how close we are in identity, and also to respect and care for others. There's a beautiful essay by Tammy Faye called Escape from the Cambodian Killing Fields, and I don't know if you've had a chance to read it yet.
I did, actually.
Yes, and she has so much gratitude for America, for accepting her, letting her in after she had lost both of her parents, two of her children, her sister, her niece and nephew, her dog. In total, she lost 37 immediate family members during the Khmer Rouge reign in Cambodia. So here's a person, a woman, who has suffered, whose suffering I could never even imagine 1/10 of or 1/100 of. And yet she's grateful to be in this country. So I learned from her too.
We have so much to learn from one another. And in that vein, if you could put this book, All the Women in My Family Sing, if you could put it into the hands of one person or one group, who would it be?
I would hand this book to all men. And I really believe that women's voices have been muted for so long. And men and women don't think alike. We don't necessarily work in the same ways, but I think men in general, all men could learn so much from reading these essays.
It's so true. We don't work in the same way, and that's fine, but we should respect one another for it. I want to know where you got the title that I love so much, All the Women in My Family Sing.
I published my memoir in 2005, Space Between the Stars, My Journey to an Open Heart. And after I published that, then I moved into my new life. I divorced. I started writing my second memoir, and I went back to school to get my master's. I just started doing all of these wonderful self-care events and things. And I had a dream one night, and this title came to me. And I thought I was going to name my second memoir, All the Women in My Family Sing, because my mother is Irish English, my cousin is Japanese, we just have this rich breadth of women in our family. But I finished my second memoir, but I didn't really want to publish it. So when I started working on the anthology, I said, oh my gosh, this is so perfect.
That was Deborah Santana, editor of All the Women in My Family Sing, Women Write the World, Essays on Equality, Justice, and Freedom. She also has a nonprofit, Do a Little, that serves women and girls in health, education, and happiness. She also collaborates with organizations that work to prevent and heal relationship and sexual violence, improve the lives of America's abused and neglected children, and a worldwide community of artists and allies who work for empowerment, opportunity, and visibility for women artists. The average military family moves every 2 to 3 years. Their household goods are supposed to move with them, but that doesn't always happen. Some families report that their possessions were lost, damaged, or stolen during moves, and they say the military doesn't do much to help. Carson Frame reports from San Antonio, Texas.
Sarah Toronto's forehead knots with frustration as she looks through old photos on her laptop.
I probably have thousands of photos on this little drive here that I hand carried with me, thank God.
She's an amateur photographer who loves to capture images of her life with family and all the places they've been stationed with the Army.
This was where my husband had all of his Army achievement medals, all the coins, they call them.
But she never expected to need the photos as documentation. The Torontos moved from Germany to San Antonio in May. The Army paid for their move and selected the moving company. But when their shipment of furniture and household items arrived in Texas, somebody had ransacked it.
They went through everything. I mean, just empty box after empty box. That was a dollhouse that my uncle built me when I was a kid. You can see on the other side, they had actually sliced it open looking for stuff on the inside of it.
The shipment had been robbed in transit for a loss Toronto estimates at $36,000. Other service members coming from Germany had similar problems. Toronto went up the chain from the local Army Claims Office to the Secretary of Defense, trying to figure out who was accountable.
It probably took me almost 2 weeks of calling almost every day to different places, asking the question, okay, I'm having a trouble with our moving company. I want somebody aware of what's going on, and I want to see if I can get them punished. Who do I go to? And that was what everybody was like, I don't know.
Every year, the Defense Department moves about 430,000 people and spends more than $2 billion doing it. But nobody keeps track of how many have problems. Kelly Ruska is with the National Military Family Association. She says overseas moves are especially troublesome because they're more complicated. Most problems are relatively minor, but thefts do occur.
We've heard cases where somebody will open a box and it'll be labeled books and it'll be filled with bricks. So sort of like a bait and switch type thing.
Even for more typical problems like damaged furniture or accidental loss, Ruska says families often don't get back what they think the items are worth. And she says sometimes military contracted movers just wait out families who file claims.
You know, the companies have just really drug their feet, haven't been as responsive, and I think they just hope that, you know, the family's going to forget about it and move on.
Transcom, the U.S. Transportation Command, is the government entity responsible for moving military families. But it doesn't systematically track complaints. Most are handled by local claims offices. Still, Transcom leaders say they communicate with those offices enough to hold movers accountable. They say the Toronto's mover was eventually suspended for failing to prevent the theft. And Colonel Ralph Lonesborough, chief of Transcom's personal property division, says cases like the Toronto's are not typical.
Right now we're at around 91% customer satisfaction. But of course, one of the things we realize when you're talking 430,000 people, that 9% represents about 35 to 40,000 people that are not satisfied with their moves.
To address that, Transcom is reworking move.mil, the website where families set up their moves. Lonesborough says that will make it easier for families to get help with problems and help Transcom find out about those problems. But that will come too late for Sarah Toronto, whose family still hasn't been fully reimbursed for their stolen items.
Yeah, all of this, I mean, this was in my bathroom.
She holds up a broken canvas with a child's drawings smeared across the front. Wants a birthday gift from her daughter.
She wrote me a little note on the back. It was like one of the sweetest things she'd ever given me so far. Even now, I just want to go wring somebody's neck because I'm never going to be able to fix this.
In her case, some losses can't be recouped. Reporting from San Antonio, I'm Carson Frame.
This story was produced by the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration that reports on American military life and veterans. And now writer Dr. Jerry Burns delves into allegorical territory.
My husband Barry and I were doing storytelling work in the South. We happened to drive home through Virginia on the day that the white supremacist rally and counter-protest happened in Charlottesville. We had supper at a small local restaurant about a half hour away from the city, and the people were talking about it, but they weren't focused on the violence. They were concerned about the monuments. What is going to happen next, carving the faces off Mount Rushmore? I listened to them, trying to gain insight into something that was so different from what I believed. The theme of the conversation centered on how wrong it is to try to erase history. I was reflecting on their position when I came upon a friend's story on social media. It goes like this. Katie has a young son who loves to color. One day, Ethan raced into the kitchen, waving a piece of paper like a flag. Mama, Mama, look what I made! Katie looked at the paper. She couldn't immediately make out what it was. What an interesting shape. Tell me about it, she said with the diplomacy of a caring parent. Her son said, I made what I made. Come, I'll show you. The boy led her out of the kitchen. They passed the living room and turned left into the bathroom. Her son pointed to the throne. See? I made what I made. Katie looked at the paper, and then she looked at what was in the bowl. Yes, indeedy. He got the basic shape and color of what he made just right. Nice job, Ethan. You really like to draw. She stroked his head and added, Now, honey, can we flush? He pressed the lever and took her hand. He led her into the kitchen and stood hopefully near the refrigerator where other works of childhood art hung. She smiled at him and hung it up there on the freezer. Her husband later pointed out that she had hung it near the magnetic business card from the local plumber. Accidental irony, perhaps? As different members of the family came and went into the kitchen, they had various reactions to the new artwork. Some were indifferent. Others didn't like it. And one person was downright offended by it. How can you put that up in a place where people eat? The only one who loved it was its creator. Whenever extended family came over, it was prime discussion fodder around the supper table after the kids left to play. Not exactly an appetizing discussion, but there you have it. Most people didn't like to see it, especially in the kitchen around food, exclaimed one particularly upset great aunt. While Katie and her husband were proud of their son's pride in his artwork, when they thought about it honestly, they too were kind of grossed out by it. Katie said, I mean, his pictures of the cat are cute, and so are his drawings of trees. They're up on the fridge. Do we need this too? So it was decided. They took the picture down and gave it to Ethan to put in his room. They replaced it with his next work of art, a fried egg, which fit the fridge theme. While they wanted to honor his desire to memorialize, what he made, he was the only one who wanted that memory. Since nobody else liked it, and some were really upset about it, they decided that it wasn't fair to subject others to an upsetting artistic subject in the public spaces of their home. Now, everyone in Katie's family has what they want. The boy keeps his precious memory where he stores his treasures, and other family members keep their appetites when they grab a glass of milk. Katie, a lifelong resident of the South, thinks her family story shows why taking down Civil War monuments is important. Now, let me be clear. No one is equating the Civil War monuments with the subject of Ethan's artistic impulse. This anecdote is simply an allegory for considering people's comfort in public spaces. While the monuments may well be artistic representations of history, they are also symbols of a system of oppression, oppression that didn't go away after the war ended. It remains explicitly and implicitly impacting African American lives and the institutions of our country. History is important and should not be erased. We must remember the good, the bad, and the ugly that went before. But I think that Katie's story is valuable because it suggests that the act of taking statues down doesn't have to equate with erasing history. Ethan's drawing was not destroyed. It was relocated from the public spaces of their home out of consideration for others' feelings. His family didn't glorify and celebrate a subject that was distasteful to so many who came upon it. Like Ethan's picture, Civil War monuments can be placed in museums and other locations where those who value them can choose to visit them at will, instead of leaving them in everyone's path and upsetting people who come upon such monuments in their everyday existence. Governments can simultaneously respect those who want to preserve the monuments and those who don't want to glorify the pain and suffering that they symbolize. It seems to me that the compromise that worked for Ethan's family can also work in the public spaces of our nation's communities. I mean, it isn't just a saying that mothers know best.
Dr. Jerry Burns is a storyteller, writer, and educator living in New York's Hudson Valley. You can find her at storycrafters.com. She also is an adjunct professor in the Department of Communication at the State University of New York at New Paltz. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1494.